drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. When you turn on the television or watch a documentary on the environment, what do you hear? Is it all doom and gloom, or are there solutions offered? Damon Gammoe, who brought us The Sugar Film, has a new documentary called 2040. Damon has come in to the studio to talk to me about his film and solutions. Damon, welcome.
Hi, Patricia.
So let's unpack that. The facts are that over many, many years, environmental change has occurred. Where do you start to find truth-based solutions?
Yeah. So before even filming anything in this production, we spent 8 months with some researchers and interviewed more than 100 scientists and academics and economists right around the world to see if these solutions did actually exist. And I was pretty staggered to learn how many things we can do and how many people are rolling up their sleeves and getting this done. But yeah, the challenge was to disseminate what was accurate and what was sensationalist, and that took a lot of work. But we particularly collaborated with a group called Project Drawdown in America, and they've spent 8 years, it's 200 academics that came together and mapped the 100 most substantive solutions to not just mitigate global warming, but actually reverse it.
Okay, so let's do a bit more of a, you know, bigger macro think here. Why did you think something like this would be an important thing to put in a film? Why did you want to do this?
So I'm a father and I had a two-year-old at the time, and as you alluded to, just the torrent of negative stories about the environment and the future that she was going to inherit was, I felt a bit paralysed by that and didn't know how I was going to communicate that to her, and I guess wanted to see if there were things I could tell her that we could do. And so it was really trying to restore some balance to that narrative. And luckily I spoke to an environmental psychologist quite early, a woman named Renee Lertzman, and she really taught me through the neuroscience around when we receive so much information that comes with this dread or overwhelm, it can actually activate parts of our brain that shut down the parts where we problem solve and think creatively. So if we are constantly and only getting that negative information, you can understand why so many people are disengaged from it. So I guess this is just to offer up, like going to the doctor. You want the diagnosis, but you also want to hear what you can do about the problem. So I'm just trying to, I guess, bring some balance to that story.
Is that a flaw in the environmental movement, that it's done too much to tell you what's wrong? Because what you've described is how I feel, I'll be honest. I hear a lot of this doom and gloom and I just feel like, goodness, what are we going to do?
I mean, I guess you could say it's a flaw, but also that's kind of what scientists do so well, is dissect and analyse a problem. It's a reductionist process in itself. So it's not really their job to do anything else but analyse the problem. And I think that's where storytellers can really get involved, or filmmakers or songwriters, is how do we disseminate some of that information, make it more accessible, use language that people can connect with. I think sometimes it is hard to know what anthropogenic means or negative emissions mean to people. It doesn't evoke any emotion in us. So I really wanted to use the film to try and do that and bring in families and communicate it in a different way. But also, yeah, I think it's important to know what's going on, and we've done that very well. But I think it's just time to just restore the balance, because that's what motivates us, is hope and the ideas that we can achieve things. And in a time where we are really wrestling with quite a dystopian narrative going on at the moment, I think especially for our children, we need to remind them that there are things we can do.
So it's a pretty big project, right? Mm. Like, environmental degradation is a really big area. So where did you start with solutions? Because there's a lot of areas and solutions.
Yeah, that was the tough part, condensing all the things that are out there. And I guess the important aspect to choosing the solutions was saying, what are the ones with cascading benefits? So no silver bullet solutions. And what were the ones that had a profound impact on communities, security, job creation, so that even if we didn't have this climate problem, all the solutions I show in the film, we do anyway. You know, our soils have got 60 years. We've got 60 years of topsoils left. So there are solutions that we can pull the carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil to improve the quality of our foods and retain more water. We should do that anyway. Regenerating the oceans. We know most of them are dry now. There's deserts. We're losing fish populations. There's a solution in the film that looks at really restoring and regenerating ecosystems in the ocean. Empowering girls and women. Again, we should do that regardless. But the stats on the UN say if we get that right, we can actually avoid 1.1 billion people, extra extra people on the planet by 2050, which has a profound impact on resources and the climate. So it was really trying to find those solutions that benefited a wide range of people or animals or whatever it might be, as well as helping the climate issue.
So this is a documentary. You obviously had to choose. Were there things that you excluded at the end?
Yeah, I mean, the first cut of the film was about 3 hours and 20 minutes and painfully boring and information dense. And, you know, again, trying to make it accessible to families and entertaining, really. We tried to get it down to about 95 minutes. So thankfully, we've got support to keep these stories going on our platform for the next few years and to really, we've got an impact, sort of an action plan that people can get involved with. They can find out what they can do on their own or in their communities to really contribute to this. But yeah, probably the biggest thing I had to leave out was just looking at some of the rules of the game economically, some of the trade treaties, things like that that are blocking up our progress at the moment. But again, it just felt like a different film. I really wanted this to be things we could fight for instead of fight against.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Filmmaker Damon Gammo is my guest tonight, and we're talking about his film 2040. So what happens in 2040 if we take all your solutions on board?
Well, I call it an exercise in fact-based dreaming. So it sort of says anything I show my daughter in the future in 2040 has to exist right now. I can't make anything up. So it's not sort of a utopian fantasy, which would be a really bad parenting thing to say to her, hey, it's all going to be fine. It sort of says if we extrapolated on the things we already have, here's what the world could look like. So I think that's what a lot of people are taking away from the film, is that we have everything we need right now. We just need, obviously, the political will, the leadership. We need people to galvanise and really know that this is possible, especially at a time when I think people are losing hope.
You travelled to Bangladesh. Who did you meet and what did you learn about energy consumption there?
So, yeah, Bangladesh is probably 10 to 15 years ahead of Australia in terms of how they're distributing energy at the moment. So they're setting up decentralised microgrids right around the country. So any home that has a solar panel and a battery is given this sort of box that allows them to connect to another home with the same setup, and those houses together form a grid. So they become resilient, they're separate from the main grid. As we know, they get a lot of natural disasters there. So if the grid gets shut down, they're able to survive on their own as an independent community. And all the money also stays within that economy because they're buying and selling the energy from each other instead of it going to a large corporation somewhere else. So it was quite inspiring to see how that's growing around the country, through Africa, through India as well. And I know the technology is starting to be applied in Australia. I know Monash have just linked up their buildings. There's housing estates in Perth now that are trialling it. So I really feel like that could be quite an energy revolution in the next 10 years in this country.
Where else did you travel for the film?
We went to Tanzania, which was quite remarkable. Went to Bangladesh, America, right through Europe. We interviewed about 110 children around the world as well, and I asked them what their vision of 2040 is so that they really guide the narrative of the film. It's not my version of the future.
What sort of things did the kids say to you?
Oh, they're pretty remarkable. I mean, I'm on a Q&A tour around the country at the moment, and just the questions that the kids are asking, they're so eloquent, they're so well-versed in what's going on at the moment, and there were moments that were really confronting. Some of them were really emotional about what's going on, and others were really inspired to be a part of really large change, which again gave me a lot of hope. But depending on which country we were in, they really had different answers. So the Tanzanian kids, their 2040 was sealed roads and factories, whereas in the US they were very political. All the kids were talking about Trump and about how we need a kid president. And in Sweden it was not harming animals. So it just depended where we were, depending on the answers they gave.
You cover energy, food consumption, our oceans, livestock, fish and population. What was the thing that took you by surprise?
A couple of things. Definitely the empowerment of girls and women. So the stats say that if we get that right, at the moment most girls that are forced to leave school have five or more children, and they leave school because of being forced into work or religion. And if they're able to finish school, if they're given access to reproductive health services and job opportunities, they'll choose when and how many children they have. And that number's about two. So that makes a difference of 1.1 billion people by 2050. So we should be empowering the girls regardless. But like I said, we then get this cascading benefit. And also seaweed. I mean, that's really not talked about at the moment. But seaweed is the fastest growing organism in the world. It grows half a metre a day and over 50 metres long. So it's just turbocharged sequestering that carbon out of the atmosphere. But at the same time, it can restore ecosystems in the ocean. It actually cleans the water, makes it more alkaline to let the ecosystem thrive. And now it's being used for biofuels, fibres, plastics. If you add it as a 2% input into cattle feed, it can reduce their methane emissions by up to 90%. So it's quite a wonderful solution that has no vested interest yet. There's nothing political about it. There's just people right around the world starting to develop these large seaweed forests out at sea to try and regenerate the ecosystems.
How about in Australia, for someone who's listening in Melbourne or Sydney, you know, outback Queensland, wherever people listen to RN Drive, what sort of solutions can someone just living a suburban life, like, you know, working, going to school, implement in their own lives? If they don't want to be an activist or, you know, enter, join the environmental movement, but they'd like to be contributors.
Well, I think people, when they see the film, you know, all these solutions are very practical and do apply to local communities and regions. And so one that's particularly exciting is the regenerative agriculture movement that's happening around the world at the moment. And Australia is pretty much on the forefront of that in terms of our farmers and how they're teaching people around the world. And again, that's just a really simple solution because it allows farmers to regenerate their lands, put that carbon back into the soil and retain water, which is a huge issue in this country. And the stats are that for every percentage of carbon that you add to the soil, 30 centimetres, it increases the water holding capacity of that soil by 166,000 litres per hectare. So it's a phenomenal thing to do. And I've just seen some farms recently out in Australia, and the ones that have done these practices over the last 5 or 10 years, you can just see the difference in their farms compared to people that aren't doing these practices. The resilience is quite extraordinary, the biodiversity that returns to the land. And I think the more we can connect people to their farmer again and understand how important that link is to the food we're eating, especially in the cities. And again, it allows farmers to be brought into this conversation and empowered. But again, we need to help them. We need to transition them to this process, and it's not we can't ask them to take a risk and do this on their own. And we really need people to get involved. And if people do go to our website, whatsyour2040.com, we've teamed up with about 50 different organisations around the world where you can activate your own plan based on your preferences and passion and what you want to do in your community. And we'll help you decide what you can do to take action. So some of them are on a small scale, and others are on a much larger version.
Sweden seems to be a success story according to your film. What is Sweden doing?
Yeah, they're doing lots of things right. It's funny, they don't even have an environmental movement per se in Sweden. They just take it as a given that you look after the environment and it's, you know, part of your health. The doctors prescribe walking in nature there as well. They really look after their parks. But an initiative we looked at is how they've put these little chutes out the front of everyone's home and it collects the food waste twice a day. So food waste, if it was a country, would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases behind China and the US. So they collect people's food waste, they extract the methane and run all their public buses and cars off that methane, and then give the leftover, the digestates, to the farmers who then spray it on their soils as a natural fertilizer. So it's just a wonderful solution and closes that loop on the resource use.
And that's done at the government level, right?
Correct, yeah.
What sort of solutions could we apply in Australia, not just, I'm saying, at the local level, but at a government level?
Yeah, I guess that was probably the disappointing thing of making the film, was seeing how far Australia is behind the rest of the world in a lot of solutions, and that was tough. I mean, I grew up, you know, really having faith in this country, and I do love living here, and we're very lucky, but I think we've got so many resources that we're probably not putting to the best use, and especially when it comes to the renewables. I mean, we should be a net exporter of solar. We should be, you know, helping to power Singapore and Indonesia and Southeast Asia. So there's a huge opportunity there. And again, I just don't think the message has been sold well enough that these solutions, as we say, can benefit communities, can create huge amounts of jobs and security. But I think that needs to be better told, and that's what we really tried to do in the film, that this is a chance to create a better life, and especially in this country. But I think there's a lot of fear about change, which is completely understandable and probably a failure on the environmental movement's part.
Let's talk about that. I think that's actually, you've just hit, and we've just had a federal election.
Yeah,
I think that's been one of the themes, the role of the environment movement in bringing people with them rather than just looking like they're saying, look at the Adani issue, for instance, in Queensland.
100%. And I'm quite new to this, so I want to be careful that there are people out there that have done great things. But as an objective observer who is new to this, I do, that makes me frustrated. And I think what we're seeing recently is this anti-Queensland narrative that's emerged, which is just nonsense. To imply that these people don't care about the environment or care about their kids' future is just ridiculous. But again, what isn't being sold to them is the opportunity to actually have a cleaner future, to look after your kids, create jobs and create better communities. That just got completely lost during the election, and I think that's a great shame. And we've got to be careful that we do need to include everyone, and we have a lot of that in the film, that we need to transition these communities from coal, or if there's going to be losses in the automotive industry, we need to not leave anyone behind.
Because it's perfectly rational for people to worry about their own material conditions going backwards.
Of course it is. That's right. We all value. I do it as well. I cherish my family. I want to look after their security. I do care about the environment. But if that's not right at home, then it's harder for me to get involved in the larger picture. And I think that gets forgotten. And we're at a really important moment here. And we've got to make sure that we move forward in a really considered and empathetic way.
2040. What do you think 2040 could look like?
Well, it's all there in 93 minutes. I've laid it out. I guess the basics are that I hope that we have, you know, you think of most Hollywood films and their portrayal of the future, they're inherently dystopian. There's no nature. There's robots. They're usually chasing humans. We're all living in slums. I think we've got to be careful. That's the imagery we're throwing up and showing our children. The future that I portray is one where there is a lot more nature. We've got more urban food projects. Our cities are designed for humans instead of cars. We've got regenerated landscapes. Our oceans are thriving again and providing food and income for communities. We've empowered girls and women, which has had a huge impact around the planet. And that we've got a stronger sense of community. You know, we're not as isolated and hyper-individualized that we are right now. We've actually found better ways to come together and solve some of these problems.
Is it as simple as just changing our behaviour?
No. I mean, you know, right through history, I think you see that change is never linear. There's no simple way to do it. And that sort of the individual behaviour model, I think, is really interesting, not in the accumulative effect of what it might have of us each having a keep cup. I think it's about sending signals that we are social animals. And if there's a fire raging and someone grabs a bucket and puts out that fire, someone else is more inclined to grab a bucket and help them. And I think the stats even around solar energy is really interesting now, that if you put panels on your roof, it actually, the chances of your neighbour putting panels actually goes up exponentially, because you're sending a signal about a cultural norm and what is the right thing to do. So I think that's more where the discussion's at right now. We do need people to find their agency at the moment. You know, it's not, I think whoever won the election wasn't going to come in, wave a magic wand, it was all going to happen. Again, this is a call to action for people to get galvanised and contribute in their own way in their community or their school or their workplace. And that's really why I made the film and all the suite of tools off the back of it, just to give people the opportunity to get involved who do care.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Patricia.
Filmmaker Damon Gammo has been my guest in tonight's Drawing Room. His film 2040 is in cinemas, and there's also an accompanying handbook available called 2040, a handbook for the regeneration.